White Rocket Entertainment.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Episode 002, David Michelinie on Iron Man.
It's the Avengers Assemble podcast from the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net. Now, here's your host, Van Allen Plexico.
Hello, and welcome to the Avengers Assemble podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net. In association with the Earth Station One Network. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and in episode two, this episode, we are featuring an interview with a legend in Avengers history, in Iron Man history, in Spider-Man history, in Marvel Comics history, and comics in general, and that is David Michelinie. David teamed up with John Romita Jr. and Bob Layton for a seminal and epic run on Iron Man back in the late 70s, and about the same time, he was brought on to script and then write the Avengers themselves. And so there was a period there where he was doing both Iron Man and the Avengers at the same time and taking both books to new heights while at the same time writing an Avengers novel, The Man Who Stole Tomorrow. So in this episode and in episode three, I'll present the first and second half of my interviews with David Michelinie. David was kind enough to spend a great deal of time talking to me about both of those subjects, plus Spider-Man and a few other things. So on this episode, we're going to talk about Iron Man and his great run with the character, where he was coming from with it, what he was trying to do, how he and Bob Layton worked together, and so on. And it's a great conversation you'll enjoy. In episode three, we'll talk more about his run on the Avengers as well as Spider-Man. So buckle up, because here we go with part one, David Michelinie, one of the great Marvel creators, on Iron Man. All right, I am pleased to welcome aboard the Avengers Assemble podcast our very first guest and one of my absolute favorites. I'm so excited to have him on this early in the series, and that is David Michelinie. David, welcome aboard the Avengers Assemble podcast.
Thank you very much, Van. I'm honored to be here.
All right. Well, you have a long and storied and, dare I say, legendary history with these characters and these stories, both in terms of the Avengers and also in particular Iron Man, among some others. And Iron Man, of course, being my favorite Marvel character, I have a lot of stuff to ask you about both Avengers and Iron Man. So we'll start out talking about whichever one you want to, really. But before we get into some specifics on that stuff, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about kind of how you ended up writing Marvel and DC and other comics and stuff like that?
Oh, my secret origin?
Yes, tell the secret origin story. Or son of...
Well, beg pardon?
I said, or the son of origin story.
Well, I have no son that I know of, so I'll have to go with my origin.
Okay.
Let me see. I graduated from college and was working for a commercial film production company in Indiana. I quit that and was wondering what I was going to do for a while, and DC Comics started something they called the apprenticeship program, where they would bring unknowns or people who wanted to get into the business into New York to work in the offices and learn the business. And I think the only person who actually went through that was Marty Pasco. But I submitted some writing samples, and for some reason they didn't go to the apprenticeship program. They went to Joe Orlando's office, Joe being an editor at DC at the time, and they went on the slush pile, which, as I'm sure you well know, is unsolicited manuscripts. then Joe's assistant editor, Michael Fleischer at the time, had a little, you know, had a few minutes after lunch, had nothing to do, read the top script. It was mine, so he sent me a letter saying, you show potential, but we can't work with anyone outside of the New York City area. So 2 weeks later, I had closed out all of my commercial obligations, and I moved to New York. I showed up on DC's doorstep, knocked on, hey, here I am. And they were stunned and kind of had to give me a chance. So that's how I actually got into comics. I worked for DC for 5 years, and then there was some problems, and I left, and I called Jim Shooter at Marvel. I met Jim at an industry dinner sometime before, and called Jim at Marvel. I said, "Can I get some work for Marvel?" And he said, "Would today be too soon?" And I was incredibly flattered. Unfortunately, I was still had several months on a contract with DC, but as soon as I got through that contract, I went over to Marvel. And Jim had been writing The Avengers and trying to run this huge company, and he didn't have time for both, so he handed me, I think it was 17 pages of an Avengers story, and asked me to write it, do the script. And that was my first work at Marvel. And the first few issues that I did under Jim's over Jim's plot. And then when he left, I took over, and that's how I became a writer in comics, and then how I end up at Marvel writing The Avengers.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Okay, so I first want to ask you some stuff about, let's see. So you wrote Avengers first before Iron Man?
Yeah, that was the first thing I wrote. And I when I was doing those fill-ins, ostensibly fill-ins, that just doing the scripting, I think that's when Iron Man came open, and I was assigned Iron Man. So I actually scripted Avengers first, but was assigned the Iron Man regular gig before the regular gig on Avengers, and I ended up writing them both.
So, all right, well, then let me figure this out. So when you were scripting Avengers, was it before the end of the Korvac saga? Because you came in right after the Korvac saga on the Avengers as your own book, right?
Yeah, no, the first one I did over Jim's plot was 173, which was part of the Korvac saga.
Okay.
And I did two others, and then Jim finished the Korvac saga. I mean, my last one that I just scripted was issue 176. I took over at 181, so between there, those two issues, Jim closed out the Korvac saga and left the book, and left it in my hands.
Okay, so so the Iron Man and the Avengers gigs kind of happened almost simultaneously then?
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow. Gosh, no wonder you're such a favorite of mine. You were writing my two favorite books at about the same time, at glorious...
Well,
and doing it so well, you know.
Oh, well, shucks. I wanted to please you, Van. I did my best.
You knew I was down there in Sylacauga, Alabama, and I was anxiously sitting by the mailbox waiting for my new issues to arrive in their little brown wrapper, and you did the best job you possibly could to make me happy, didn't you? That's awesome.
that was my motivation.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, well, so let's talk about Iron Man first. You came in to Iron Man, I want to say I'm doing some of this from memory, and some I have a cover gallery and some notes here, but I want to say 116, and that's I believe Bill Mantlow was just wrapping up his, just I think, one of the great runs in the book's history. I love the Bill Mantlow run. You know, he took it over full time pretty much with 96. And we had the this great storyline with Midas, which was really kind of a foreshadowing of what would be done with Obadiah Stane after you left, interestingly enough. I think of those as kind of bookending your run. And then Mantlow followed that up with the outer space, the colonizers, Jack of Hearts. So there was all kinds of really wacky stuff going on. Iron Man had like a sidekick in Jack of Hearts. He had been involved with Madame Mask. He had stuff kind of going on with S.H.I.E.L.D. that wasn't happy with him. Jasper Sitwell almost tried to kill him. There was a lot of crazy stuff going on in Iron Man all over the map with Bill Mantlow's run. And then he leaves, and I believe you take over right after that. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, I think so.
So what in the world did you think when you looked at all the loose ends that he had lying around?
Well, ironically enough, before I was assigned the regular gig on Iron Man, I had never read an Iron Man comic. I read a lot of Marvels. I was a big Marvel fan, but it was most superhero-wise, it was Spider-Man. I read Spider-Man a lot. But I read like Conan and Submariner and Silver Surfer and all the kind of side characters more than the main characters, and I'd never read Iron Man. So I was teamed with Bob Layton as the anchor and the co-plotter, and Bob had read Iron Man all his life, loved Iron Man, his favorite character. So he knew the entire history. I knew nothing. So it worked out well, because if I came up with an idea that had already been done, he could say, no, we can't do that. Plus, but I had a fresh viewpoint of the character, having not, gone through years and years of reading it. So it worked out well, and I went and I read the last couple of issues that came out before 116, that are where I started. And I didn't read all the stuff with Jack of Hearts and all that crazy stuff. I didn't go back that far. I just tried to familiarize myself with the situation that I was where I was taking over. And it seemed, there was a lot of negative stuff. S.H.I.E.L.D. trying to take over and the problems with the government and women problems and everything. So I just tried to take that and try to figure out, okay, here's this guy who's only superpower is his brain. Basically, he's literally a self-made hero. He, wasn't bitten by a radioactive spider, didn't come from another planet, wasn't bathed in gamma radiation. He's a human. He's a really smart human. Now, with all this pressure, what would he do now? And that's the angle that I took after, what had gone before. And in reality, I really didn't know a lot about what had gone before, except for the last couple of issues.
I don't think there's any doubt you revolutionized that character. And I, as somebody who had read it for, several years before you started, I came in at the beginning of Mantlow. It just was, and then I go back and read the earlier issues from before that when I was too little. It's very striking. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that the combination of you and Bob together, kind of having the two different perspectives, absolutely clicked, because this is what's fascinating to me is, every writer who wrote Iron Man before you, all the way up through including Mantlo and that in the right around 100, every writer focused on Tony as like this damaged, oh, my heart's failing. Oh, no, I got to get to the electrical outlet and plug in. Oh, what am I going to do? And you really turned him into kind of an American James Bond. Did you see it that way?
Well, I remember, I don't have those issues in front of me. I just have the Avengers, but I remember there was one issue that we did that had Tony Stark on, didn't even have Iron Man on it, with like a Walther P-38 in his hand in an alleyway with bullets flying. And that's exactly what we were kind of going for. We thought ourselves, okay, here's this guy. He's really competent. He knows all kinds of things besides flying around in an iron suit. Let's focus on the guy, and people never, we had this one issue where Iron Man hardly even appeared at all. And nobody complained, so I guess we were doing something right.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It was a great character already, but you guys just opened up whole new vistas for him and really changed him fundamentally, because, like I said, the first 100 or so issues, it was a different supporting cast. It was that Pepper and Happy, and, you had, the guardsmen and all that kind of stuff, the O'Briens and everything. And when you guys came in, you just kind of like jettisoned all that and brought in all this fresh new stuff. You brought in a new secretary, Ms. Arbogast, who was fantastic. Everybody loves her. Security chief, Rhodey, of course. Everybody knows you created Rhodey. You guys created Rhodey, and who goes on to become, just this iconic character. And like I say, you shifted the focus from him being a weak physical person to not an unweak physical person, but also a really strong mental person. Like you say, his genius drives the thing from that point forward, rather than him being kind of like an invalid trapped in his own armor, always looking for electricity or something. I mean, that never hardly entered into what you guys did. You made him into you built a whole new world for Iron Man. It was like almost like a whole new character, and everybody loved it.
Well, not everybody, but enough to keep the book going at least.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt this is the seminal most iconic run in Iron Man history. To this day, people look back. I mean, there's never been anything since that touches what you guys did between, I guess, let me say, 116 and like 153, maybe something like that. That's a good long run. I mean, not many runs get to go that long.
No, well, yeah, I know. A lot of people have complained over the years that, you know, writers come and go and artists come and go. And just we, along with John Romita Jr. on that first run, we loved what we were doing. And we just had so much fun that, you know, why leave? You know, we eventually, you know, kind of one left and then the other, and for various reasons. But we just loved the characters. And we came back for a second run years later. And we're surprised we still love the character. So I think that's the thing. We had this focus. We had my fresh viewpoint, Bob's historical viewpoint. We both really had fun doing the character. And we as far as the supporting cast was concerned, we came up with people that we, again, looking at it from a realistic viewpoint, who do we need? Who would he have? He would have a secretary. Okay, what is she like? What do we need? Okay, who would have a security, head of security? He would have a lawyer. You know, he would have this. He would have a second in command. Who would a real person have? And we populated it as we went along. Okay, he would fly around when he wasn't Iron Man. You know, he'd need a pilot. There's Jim Rhodes. And also, if you want to talk about Rhodey later, there the reasons we had him. But anyway, It grew organically with what was needed, with what we thought were realistic situations and consequences, and it remained fresh with us, and we just enjoyed it, so we stayed on for 50, 60 issues, whatever it was, 40. Anyway.
Well, let me ask you this then. So, was there ever any thought or discussion between you and the other guys about, or editorial or whatever, about keeping any of the earlier cast or bringing them back or anything? Or did you just pretty much have the green light to say, let's just bring in a whole new cast here and make it a fresh thing?
Yeah, nobody ever mentioned, you know, bringing anything else back. I think when we started, Iron Man was a middle-tier title, which at that time meant it was selling about 150,000 copies a month. And it didn't seem to have a lot of energy. People didn't really pay much attention to it. I mean no insult to anybody else involved with the book before that, but we were just pretty much given a free hand, you know, and it seemed to work, because when we left after that first run, it was averaging like 235,000 copies a month. So it was obviously, you know, there's word of mouth, people are starting to pick it up, and there was more interest. So editorial and publishers thought, well, okay, it's selling better, they're doing something right, we'll just let them keep going.
And that was the time before the rise of the big comic shops and then, of course, the internet, where the word of mouth really takes off. So you guys jumped it up almost double just on word of mouth, like in people's towns and stuff. That's amazing. That's just mind-blowing.
It's very gratifying, because we never set out to sell comics. We just wanted to do fun stories. And it's very gratifying that people liked what we were doing or enjoying what we were enjoying doing.
Well, speaking of, it was before the internet, how did you and J.R. Jr. and Bob Layton, how did you guys like collaborate? Were you physically in the same place for all of it? I mean, how did that process work?
On the first run, yeah, Bob and I were living in the same small college town. We were, you know, 5 minutes away from each other, and we'd get together and we'd talk the plots out. Sometimes we'd spend like 5 or 6 hours, you know, pacing and talking, and I would take notes, and it worked out. And then I'd go home and I'd you know, structure things, add details, and type up the plot and send it in. The thing is, also, we got together socially. He'd call me up and say, "Oh, I got to go do my laundry at the laundromat. You know, let's come along. We'll have lunch sometime." And we do that. And we, of course, we talk Iron Man. So, 2 or 3 times a week, we get together. And we always talk Iron Man, not just Iron Man, of course, but characters and what might happen, and come up with ideas and stuff. So it was an ongoing process, and was very, like I say, face to face. We were good buddies, and we were working on something we both liked, and that's how that worked. Now, JR, I had I had met, but he wasn't actually involved with the plotting. He would take the plot, and he would do wonderful things. You know, he did great artwork. He was so much fun to he was a great storyteller. And so, and you know, Bob looked good over him, ink-wise. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty much a one-to-one collaboration on the plot. But the three of us, although we didn't get together and work, you know, in the same room or anything like that, it was a great combination. We were all on the same page, and I think we were all having a great time doing it.
Man, that's a laundromat I would have loved to have been doing my laundry in when you guys were in there talking about Iron Man.
No, no. He put his laundry in, then we go to the restaurant. We talk at the restaurant. And we didn't discuss it in you know, with underwear going around and dryer, you know, like that.
Yeah. Couple of other things about Iron Man, and then we'll talk about the Avengers. I could talk about Iron Man all day, obviously, but I want to get in some Avenger stuff too. But couple of villains really stand out. Now, in the first run, you guys never got to use the Mandarin. So tell me, because he had just been, you know, the Mandarin had, of course, been the big villain of issue 100 that Mantlo wrote. And was soundly defeated, and so he doesn't make a reappearance for quite a while. I just kind of want to know your thoughts overall about that character. Is he Iron Man's definitive villain? Would you have liked to have used him in your first run? And just stuff like that. What are your thoughts on the Mandarin and you're not using him or not using him?
I'm not even sure if I had read the Mandarin, any Mandarin stories before taking over Iron Man. So I had no real knowledge of him or any fondness or unfondness. I hadn't read it. It didn't occur to me, and I guess Bob didn't suggest it, so we didn't use it. I always, in my work on the book, I would consider Dr. Doom to be the ultimate Iron Man villain because they're like, you know, two pages out of the same book, one lighter and one darker. Like, you know, brothers from a different mother kind of thing, because they mirrored each other and, you know, with their intelligence and their technical knowledge. And I just thought they were a great match together and, you know, against each other. So I would put Dr. Doom as my favorite Iron Man villain. And I really don't know a lot about the Mandarin. I know we used him or I wrote him in something eventually. I'm flipping through the issues. I don't see it.
I think you had it in your second run, right?
Didn't you? On Iron Man.
Yeah.
Because I only had one. Okay. you're probably right. Let me. I have that on my computer here. Because that was Iron Man. Because I remember coming up with the hand of the Mandarin because of his rings or something. So, I'd have to go and refresh my memory, but.
It's been longer since I've read your second run. I've read your first run more recently, and plus, you know, I was a kid. It was when I first read it, so it just like blazed into my brain. So that's why I'm not as fresh, instantly recalling the second run. But I do seem to recall that you guys brought him in during that second run for a couple of issues at least. I can kind of visualize a cover.
Yeah, I'm seeing titles here on my list. There's one called China Sea, S-E-E, and one Master Blaster. I think that may have been the two-part Mandarin. But like I said, I have to go dig in the stacks and reread them to refresh my memory. But, yeah, that was Iron Man somewhere in there.
Yeah, so he's just not one of your kids. Well, you make a good point, though, that certainly you and Bob, I think, turned Dr. Doom into this great ultimate Iron Man villain, but nobody had ever thought of that before. That's what's amazing to me is that, I mean, when issue 149, 150 came out, I was a kid still, but I was like, well, of course, you know, why has nobody ever thought of this? But Dr. Doom is so identified. I mean, there's probably no Marvel villain that is more closely identified with a hero or team than Dr. Doom is with the I mean, maybe, you know, the Red Skull and Captain America or Loki and Thor, but he's right in there. I mean, Dr. Doom is almost the fifth member of the Fantastic Four. He's the crazy uncle. And so it's to imagine him out of that context. like it would just be strange to see a Doctor Doom versus Thor issue, you know, or a Doctor Doom versus Spider-Man issue. But yet you guys just jumped right on that and for the big 150th issue. So you said a little bit about it already, but kind of how did that process go of saying, hey, what about Doctor Doom? I mean, who first thought of that? Was it you? And how did that process come together of doing that as the 150?
No, Bob, that was Bob's suggestion. Bob was a big King Arthur fan. He suggested, okay. Yeah, so these are, you know, they're like modern knights. They're even dressed in armor. Mm-hmm. And so what if we took them back to the days of knights? And because Dr. Doom had a time machine, the time cube or time platform, whatever it was called. Mm-hmm. And so it just that made sense. I said, sure, that could be cool. And we could work in magic, because Dr. Doom had a connection to magic. And Tony Stark, being, you know, so technically minded, is very uncomfortable about magic, or at least was. We figured that would be logical, because, you know, how does he explain that? It's not scientific, you know. You can't make a formula, you know. Write a formula down and understand it. So it just seemed logical. It was Bob's idea, and we plotted it together, and it's one of our favorite storylines, at least mine, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a great idea how you highlight sort of that difference, where on the one hand, they're both very similar, but on the other hand, Dr. Doom is more into the magic side of it, too. And it just really clicked. I mean, it absolutely worked perfectly. That was like a... It was the 149-150, but you know what it really came across of is like one of those classic annuals or giant size issues where you have that, you know, the kind of an offbeat story that everybody goes, oh, yeah, of course, that makes sense as one big story, you know. So that always kind of struck me as like an Iron Man annual that never was, in a way. Were there any other big villains that you thought would have worked well with Iron Man that maybe you never really got to use, or that people don't talk about as much as you thought they should?
Huh. I don't remember. I don't remember there's any villains we wanted to use and didn't. I think we tried to bolster Iron Man's own rogues gallery, you know, bringing in characters and like... maybe looking at them from a different angle and making them a little more dangerous than perhaps they were in the past, maybe fitting, you know, the current status of Tony Stark and Stark International and the situations. I don't recall any ones that we didn't use that we wanted to or thought about.
Well, you're right that, I mean, his rogues gallery has always been kind of flimsy, I'm afraid, and I think that stands out in the movies, because the villains have been kind of the weak link, I think, in his movies. He doesn't, you know, the Mandarin is supposed to be his great arch enemy, and yet just didn't work well, and not many people I know liked Iron Man 3 very much. So, you know, you kind of stepped in and brought in like the Spy Master, who was an old Iron Man villain, but you made him a lot more of a substantial threat, right? And you had a nice little stint where Submariner was involved with him. You had that great pair of issues where he fought the Hulk, and then you basically took every third rate villain he's ever fought and put them all together on a team under Hammer and had Iron Man trash every one of them. So, which I truly love. Now, so tell us a little bit about that. I mean, what was the in other words, you had a nice little run there where you had him have a supporting character for a couple of issues, whether it was the Hulk, whether it was Submariner. What was the thinking there, and how do you think that came out?
I'm not sure I understand the question completely. Are you saying, like, what was the thinking behind having the same character in multiple issues?
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, You had quite a run there where you guys would bring in another hero to either fight Iron Man or then team up with him. And you had kind of like the way the Jack of Hearts was under Mantlo. You had the Hulk, you had the Submariner, you had Ant-Man, right? So I guess I'm just wondering what you guys' thought process was in bringing in these big supporting characters like that to who he sort of fights them and then teams up with them, or vice versa.
I don't know if there was any real, intrigued by all that. I think it was just when we're talking and shooting ideas back and forth and come up with, oh, what would it be? And Iron Man, okay, Hulk is the strongest around. Okay, Iron Man is as strong as his power source. Hulk is as strong as he is. Iron Man is as strong as his power source. So we put those together to point that out, to highlight the difference between the strengths of these two characters. And we had Iron Man actually knock the Hulk into orbit. And so, okay, he tapped into all the energy he could, and that's how strong he can be. But there are consequences, and it froze up his armor, and he's trapped in his armor. So these ideas come out when we're thinking about characters. As far as Submariner, I don't really remember. I know I had come up with I've been asked to do a new Submariner series early on in writing for Marvel. And I did a plot, and I can't remember the name. Alan Weiss penciled it, and then it was canceled. So it never came out, but I had been thinking about Submariner. So that probably came out when Bob and I were talking, and Submariner would be a good character to pit against Iron Man for whatever reasons. Mm-hmm. And we just come up with the idea, and I don't think it would say, okay, what popular or what big character can we use now? We would just, came out through conversations, and we would find an interesting way that these people could interact, and then a story would come from that.
I've been remiss. There's one character that I definitely need to ask you about. Like I said, when you came on the book, Tony was still kind of involved with Madam Mask, and very quickly you took that and sort of the leftover pieces from Avengers 166 with Nefaria, and kind of shuffled Madam Mask and Count Nefaria off the stage by basically crushing him under the under the Jupiter lander or whatever, right? So before so this is kind of a two-part thing. So first, tell me kind of what was going on there with were you not interested in writing Whitney Frost and you just kind of wanted to move on to new characters, or had you read Avengers 164, 165, 166 with Nefaria, and how did that all come together? Because that's something that fans have wondered about for a long time, how you kind of brought an ending to the whole Super Count Nefaria story in Iron Man.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing happened actually when Bob and I came back and did a second run. Is, you want to do your own characters, you want to do your own stories. Coming on to the book, I didn't really want to write Nefaria and Madam Mask. I had no interest in them, but I didn't want to just, have a big explosion and kill them off. I tried to have a little respect for the previous writer. Same when we took over from Denny O'Neill in the second run. He had characters and situations that neither of us were really interested in pursuing. And we did our best to try within an issue or two to resolve them to the point where fans of the book of the other previous writers wouldn't be too disappointed. There was at least some closure there, and then we can go on and develop the stories and the characters that we would, rather write. So that was the situation. I tried to at least show some respect for both the previous writer and for the readers who enjoyed those, and at the same time get around them so I could do things I wanted, was more interested in.
Yeah. Well, speaking of one of those characters you were probably more interested in, there's a character that only appeared on the covers. I'm just looking at him now and realizing this. This character only appeared on the cover of 123 and one other one. Let me see. People are like really bored now, but I want to tell us accurately. 133. But it's very, very important supporting character. You know who I might be thinking of? That we haven't talked about yet?
Okay, I'm looking at Casino Fatale and The Hero Within. Of course, I don't have my Iron Man issues, but Hero Within, I'm thinking maybe Ant-Man?
Bethany Cade.
Nope. Oh, Beth.
Yes.
Oh, we said Hero. I was thinking it was costume people.
Ah.
Oh, okay, Beth. Good old Beth. What can I tell you about her?
But tell us everything about her. She was your, I mean, the great Iron Man writers get to bring in a new girlfriend. It's like a Bond girl, right? Every Bond movie gets new Bond girls. The new Iron Man writer gets to bring in a new Tony girl. And Beth is one of the greatest ever. Everybody loves her. She had a great run there. So where did she come from, and what were you guys trying to do with her, and how do you feel it kind of played out?
Well, yeah. I guess we kind of wanted to make Tony, give him an actual girlfriend rather than go, the babe of the week kind of thing. We wanted to do a strong female character without shouting it from the rooftops. I am woman, hear me roar. This kind of feminism was, blossoming, from the 60s and 70s into the 80s. But we didn't want to show, like I say, we didn't want to have a feminist character. We wanted to show a strong woman who, is strong from her actions and her words, not from saying it. So we wanted to give him someone who was his intellectual equal, his physical equal, someone he could relate to, this incredibly brilliant, heroic man could fall in love with and share with. So we came up with Bethany Cabe. We gave her an employment situation where she could be involved in action, made her basically a bodyguard, her and Ling McPherson, her partner, in their little organization. And gave her the name. The name Bethany actually comes from seeing a sign in Delaware to go to Bethany Beach. I thought, Bethany, well, that's a pretty name. So I came up with Bethany. I don't know where Cabe came from. Maybe I just seen McCabe and Mrs. Miller on TV or something, but that's where the name came from. That's where the character. The physical description came from a magazine ad I saw, a model in a magazine ad. So I described her as that and let JR and Bob take it from there. But that was the origin of that. And she just developed organically as we needed her in stories and had how we wanted to have her relationship with Tony evolve. And eventually, I guess it was in the second run, anyway, where we revealed she knew. She's smart. Tony Stark disappears, Iron Man shows up. So we had her be one of the very few people at the time who knew his dual identity. That's where the character came from, and that's kind of what we wanted her to be there for.
So when you guys came to the end of your run, I guess 153 thereabouts the first time, did you basically set it up that she would leave the book? And I've always wondered, did you do that just to kind of clean the shelf off for the next creative team, or had they asked you to because they wanted to go in a different direction?
No one asked us to. And to be honest, I don't really remember. I'd have to go back and read that issue to jog my memory as why we did it. It may have been, to get her off the board so that no one would screw with her.
Right.
I don't really remember. But it was our decision, not someone else's.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like she found out her husband was still alive or something that she had thought was dead, and so she leaves.
Right.
Yeah,
and she felt an obligation to try to, help him. So, yeah.
Last Iron Man question. You guys famously introduced the new types of armor that we had never seen before. We had the stealth armor. We had the outer space armor, among others. I think it was the underwater armor, maybe. How did that come about? Was that I've always suspected that was as much Bob wanting to draw these things as anything. But how did that come about?
It was Bob's idea. He was the tech oriented member of our collaboration, and at the time there was no just one armor that could do anything. I think that's changed. I think with the extremist armor or something. But at the time, it was just he had this very useful and armor that could do a variety of things. But if he went into outer space, he was limited to whatever oxygen was inside the sealed suit. Same with going down underwater and so forth. So we figured he'd have specialty suits for special situations. And that's where that idea came from. And Bob loved drawing them, loved designing them. The readers seemed to love it whenever we'd put one in a story. And it was a lot of fun dealing with new abilities, you know, stealth ability, changing color, going black at night, going white if he's in the snow, that kind of thing, underwater, big clunky, and how would he deal with, you know, threats underwater when he, especially like, I don't think we ever put him on underwater armor with Submariner, but that would have been kind of fun. But anyway, yeah, that was what brought up the new, you know, the various armors, just from that idea that, what would he do in this situation?
Well, the thing that's always struck me about it is what we were talking about a minute ago, that writers before you seem to treat Iron Man as just like, that's the superhero, like it's Superman, it's Iron Man, and you don't really change it. But you guys treated Tony Stark like the character, like the hero, and the armor just became a tool that he used, and so you had no problem using different tools.
Well, that's, you know, you've hit on it, you know, hit the nail on the head, because in a way I never wrote Iron Man. I just wrote Tony Stark. I wrote Tony Stark in a business suit, or I wrote Tony Stark in a suit of armor. But that's how we viewed it. We didn't, you know, it was Tony Stark's story, and, you know, everything else just fell in after that.
Well, before we talk about the Avengers now a little bit, I want to get your impression on the Marvel movies. You've seen, because you, I don't remember if, did you create Scott Lang as Ant-Man?
I certainly did.
Yes, I thought so, but I wanted to make sure before I gave credit from somebody else. So what do you think now about having him on the big screen? I mean, you know Iron Man's going to be a big hero, but Ant-Man, Scott Lang, not even the Pyms. I mean, we had Pyms in the movie, but what do you think about Scott Lang being a movie star?
Well, I tell you, Marvel was nice enough to invite me out to the premiere in Hollywood last year, and I went out, and I was a bit, had some trepidation because, you know, I'd like most of the Marvel movies, but, you know, Scott was my guy, and okay, you know, Scott and Cassie and even Darren Cross. Mm-hmm. I sat there, and I was so relieved because I liked the movie a lot. I thought it wasn't exactly like the comics, but I thought the scripters, the directors, and Paul Rudd captured the character very well. The humor, the humanity, and most importantly, the relation between Scott and Cassie, his daughter, which is the key to his whole character, in my opinion. They made it terrifically entertaining, action, comedy, with heart. I thought it was terrific. I hope they do the second one as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think so too. So when you look at the three Iron Man movies, and I guess how he's been in the Avengers two movies, and in Civil War now, we've had a lot of Iron Man. We've had a lot of Robert Downey Jr. Iron Man on the screen. How much of Thor and Bob's Iron Man and Tony Stark do you see in the movie version, if any?
Oh, certainly there's stuff there. I mean, you know, his I loved the first Iron Man movie. I thought they did a great job. I love Robert Downey Jr. I've heard some complaints that he's now become just too much of a wise ass, you know, but I thought it worked really well. It showed I think humor shows intelligence, and the fact that he has a sense of humor not only makes the stories in the comics and in the movies more interesting, but it shows, you know, he's got a brain, and the brain works. I read that Robert Downey Jr. wanted to do alcoholism, that storyline, and that shows, you know, his increasing drinking the first two movies and his kind of losing control with the alcohol was, of course, directly from our stories, or influenced by our stories. And I have read that the producers didn't want to do alcoholism because they thought that was too much of a negative downer kind of thing to show a hero. But, you know, I thought in the third one, as you know, negative, whatever you want, I thought the Tony Stark stuff in the third one was pretty good. But my favorite part of the third one was they finally got Rhodey right. I mean, Rhodey was created to be specifically Tony Stark's friend. At the time, all of, and the comics, all of his friends were other heroes. And we thought, well, okay, Tony Stark is just a guy. He needs a friend, a buddy, a pal, someone he can hang around with, someone, you know, he can talk to. And we made Rhodey an ex-military guy, some guy who knew from guns and fists and action, so they could interact, you know, without, you know, superheroics. And they finally did that in the third one. They had Tony and Rhodey side by side, watching each other's backs, shooting the bad guys, ducking. That was the Rhodey that we saw in the comics. So I thought they got that right. There are elements, you know, of what we did in the movies, and, you know, stuff that we didn't do. But, you know, you take what you can get.
I've always said they kind of gave Hawkeye's personality to Tony Stark in a way, just to kind of liven him up a little bit, it seemed like. But it made Hawkeye more boring in a way in the movies.
Oh, well, what can I say? A guy shoots arrows. I love the idea. Oh, God, which movie it was when, you know, they had a guy, I can't remember it now, but they made a comment about it. He's a guy who shoots arrows, you know, what do you want?
Yeah.
So that was pretty fun.
All right, that was part one of the interview with David Michelinie. Again, I appreciate him coming on, and we'll have the second half of his conversation with me next time, when we'll talk mostly about the Avengers and a little bit about Spider-Man and Venom. So be sure to tune in for that. Also, check out the White Rocket Podcast, the sister show of this program. It's on iTunes and on Podbean, P-O-D-B-E-A-N. That's the White Rocket Podcast, where we talk about everything else in pop culture besides the Avengers, and the Avengers some too. We've talked lately about James Bond. We've talked about Game of Thrones. We've talked about Star Wars, several topics that we've covered in recent episodes at the White Rocket Podcast, and all the fine shows on the Earth Station One Network. But for now, we're going to get on out of here. So as always, Avengers Assemble.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.